All right. Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. Before we get to the show this week, we just launched a cool new daily column on bonappetit.com called Highly Recommend. If you're ever curious where like Julia Kramer or Alex Laney or all our editors are eating and drinking and shopping, this is a column for you. Every day we will have a cool new spot that we're into and what to do there and what to buy there and what to eat there. You can find it at bonappetit.com/highly recommend or just look for it on our Instagram feed. All right, this week's show. First up, we have a carrot cake roundtable. Because believe it or not, we now have a carrot cake recipe on each of our verticals. There is BA's Best Carrot Cake, developed by Claire Saffitz on BA.com. There is a gluten-free carrot cake, which is surprisingly good, on Healthy-ish, developed by Chris Morocco. And now, there is a recently published carrot loaf cake on Basically, created by Molly Boz. So I sit down with the three of them to talk about how each cake is different and yet similar. And then after that, I chat with senior editor Emil Stonik about a little guide he edited for our April issue of Bon Appetit called Clean Up Your Act. You know what I'm talking about. We talk about the importance of freezer clean out, how to organize your fridge, what to do with that junk drawer in your kitchen. We all have one. It's okay. Emil provides guidance that we can all use. All right, let's do this. Here is Molly, Claire, and Chris. Guys, we're talking carrot cake, and I was debating whether or not to leave this to the end or maybe just naturally come up in the course of conversation, but I'm just going to cut to it right now. Raisins or no raisins?
Raisins.
No raisins.
Whoa.
Gonna have to say no raisins based on my recipe.
Oh, okay. That was Molly Boz speaking over there.
Hello.
With the loaf carrot cake. Claire Saffitz with the BA's Best Carrot Cake. No raisins.
Well, the raisins are optional because I don't want them in there. But that's not to say that someone else who likes raisins shouldn't put them in their carrot cake.
Well, why don't you want them in there?
I don't like the wet, soft texture of raisins. So these are actually soaked in rum in the recipe, which I think does add a good flavor component. But I just don't like chewy, sweet raisins and already sweet baked goods. Which is not to say that I don't like raisins at all, because I do. But I like them in more savory kinds of things.
See, that's weird, because I'm with you. Like, I hate when you get, like, your mom, like, as a kid, would give you the cheese Danish or something in the car. And you take a bite and you get these weird, squishy raisins in there. And you're like, ah. But I've come around to raisins. I love, like, I make a celery salad, a celery sort of almond salad with parsley and stuff, and I'll throw some, like, little yellow raisins soaked in some, like, rice wine vinegar.
So savory.
Yeah, or sometimes, like, in a pilaf-y sort of, you know, sort of situation. But for some reason, like, in a cake, I'm like, no, no, no.
Agreed. Because they're already so sweet. And I think it takes a sweet dessert to, like, a cloying kind of place. So I leave them out. But I know, like, if you like raisins in your carrot cake, because that's what you always had growing up, definitely put them in. But I'll say one thing, which is that the walnuts are not optional, because I always want walnuts.
You need
some
crunch.
Kind of nut. A pecan is great, too.
Ooh.
But I want that in there.
Boz?
I'm gonna beg to differ on that one.
Mm.
Whoa.
Because I love a well-toasted, crunchy walnut as well. But when it gets baked into the loaf and then it's getting hydrated from the batter, I feel like it's crispy gone soggy in a bad way for me.
I like that. But again, as long as it's well toasted to begin with.
Which oftentimes they're not.
Okay. So we're going to talk about the differences and similarities between these three carrot cake recipes. But just to be clear, so Claire, in yours, there are walnuts, but there aren't raisins.
Optional.
Optional. But in your perfect world.
Yes,
there'd be
correct.
No raisins, but there would be walnuts. Molly, in yours, there would be raisins, but no walnuts?
No raisins, no walnuts.
No raisins or walnuts?
No raisins. No walnuts in, maybe on top.
Are there carrots in your carrot cake?
There are carrots.
I thought you were a raisin fan.
Chris
is the raisin fan.
I'm the raisin fan.
Oh, my God.
Because
okay.
You're all of you wrong.
<'Cause>
I have raisins. I have walnuts. And I have carrots. Yes, I have it all. But I've got a very savory forward cake here. I've got almond meal standing in for my flour because it's gluten-free. You know, I've got virgin coconut oil, so it's got that, like, bright, you know, kind of tropical coconut flavor. But not just any raisins, golden raisins. For me, golden raisins get a pass in places where regular raisins just don't belong.
Okay, well, this is not a raisin podcast. This is a carrot cake podcast. So before we get into the specifics of each recipe, Chris, I'm going to ask you a question.
Sure.
Why do we need three carrot cake recipes on bonappetit.com?
You know, I think if there's one thing that we've learned, it's that we have a lot of different groups of people looking at different, the content that we create, depending on what vertical, you know, or what site that they're going to, right? Is there some overlap between somebody who is a basically, you know, devotee, you know, versus healthy-ish? Like, maybe, but I feel like they're distinct communities. So I feel like we tailored carrot cake recipes to suit, you know, what all those different people are looking for. Claire's just being, you know, kind of like the most, you know, kind of close to the original, you know, most delicious, straightforward, no twists, right? Molly, you're approaching it like from like a, you know, looking at how many ingredients you're putting in.
And for more of a beginning baker than
right,
an expert baker.
It's in a loaf pan, which is just like, you know, so you don't need to have cake pans and, you know, springform pan or whatever, you know, and then I have like the healthiest, you know, the gluten-free one, you know, for people who just want, you know, the flavors of the classic, but maybe just ever so slightly lighter. You wouldn't necessarily know it's gluten-free, but it's, you know, it has at least a nod to health in the form of, you know, some Greek yogurt in the frosting and, like I said, like the almond meal and the lack of gluten from flour.
And I'll just want to add one thing. I think carrot cake as a dessert lends itself very well to gluten-free baking because it's naturally very moist from the carrots and usually it's oil-based. So it felt like a natural dessert to adapt for more of a healthy-ish audience, which maybe has some gluten, you know, wants more gluten-free kind of things and more like sort of health-forward ingredients.
Sure.
Okay, Claire, can you start us off, like what constitutes a classic carrot cake in terms of the actual cake itself before we get to the frosting?
I'd love to. So to me, carrot cake is an oil-based spice cake that has carrots added to it. Like at its core.
What does oil-based mean? What is that? I mean,
not,
I know
not
what
butter,
that means.
Not a butter-based cake.
What is a butter-based cake, for instance?
Your classic like yellow cake, birthday cake, white cake, all starts with creaming, butter, and sugar together.
Oh, okay.
So carrot cake is a little denser than those butter-based cakes because you're not doing that initial stage of whipping together the sugar and the butter.
Sort of aerating,
which aerates,
and whatnot. Gotcha.
Right.
Okay. Did you know that, Molly?
I knew it.
Professional over
yeah,
there.
These guys are pros. So a oil-based cake, rather, you start typically, I mean, sometimes they're cakes that you just like mix all the wet and all the dry and you stir them together and that's it. In this cake, you start by whipping the eggs and the sugar, and that does work a little bit more air into it.
Whole eggs?
Whole eggs, yeah. And then you add in the oil, and that emulsifies
you like
it.
Like that question, Molly? Like sometimes you can separate the eggs, you know.
Great question, yeah. Adam.
But overall, it's a denser texture than your average butter cake. And there's a lot of ingredients kind of weighing it down, also like the carrots and whatever add-ins, walnuts, raisins, what have you. But I think at its core, carrot cake is like a well-spiced cake. Oil, so it's much more moist, a little bit denser, and then there's carrots added to it. So you can, you know, you can do a similar style with other kinds of ingredients, like parsnip cake became kind of a trendy thing, like zucchini bread, that kind of thing, where it's essentially like the same kind of base. This one just has carrots.
So you make a batter, an oil-based batter with eggs and sugar and whatnot, and flour, regular white flour in yours?
This is an AP flour, I believe.
And then you are to that adding the shredded carrots, walnuts.
Warm spices.
Let's talk about the spices.
So this one has cinnamon, ground ginger, nutmeg. I don't really like nutmeg at all, but I do think it's right in a carrot cake. There's something to me that like can read very soapy. But I like that combination of spices. If you're like a clove person, you really love that super spicy hit, you can add that. Cardamom is another one that like kind of does the same kind of work in a cake. But I like the kind of classic combo of cinnamon, ginger, and nutmeg, and they all work together really well.
Are those spices in all three of your cakes?
Well, I had to make a choice here because I have only a few ingredients to work with. So
talk to us about that.
Okay, so basically recipes never exceed
basically
10 ingredients.
Being the website, not just basically as a word you say before
right.
you start
so
a
the
sentence.
Recipes that I develop for basically never exceed 10 ingredients, which makes it particularly hard when we're baking because there's a set number of ingredients that are necessities. So then beyond that, I had to make some cuts. And so as Claire was just saying, cinnamon and ginger are fundamentals. Those are both in there.
And that's ground ginger?
Ground ginger and ground cinnamon. I did not use nutmeg. Something had to go.
Yeah.
So my version of the cake is actually, I think, really true to what Claire just said, which is it's most pared down fundamental version of a spice cake. That's what it is. It's an oil-based cake. There are warm spices in it, and there are carrots in it. There aren't nuts. There aren't raisins. There's none of the extra add-ins because I had to simplify.
And talk to us about going with the loaf as opposed to the rounds.
Yeah, I think for starters, people think that loaf cakes are easier to make than regular cakes, even if they can be made just the same way and baked in a 10-inch round cake pan. But also just because our Basically reader is more likely to own a loaf pan and have made banana bread, for example, or zucchini bread in the past.
Or meatloaf.
Meatloaf in
you,
a loaf pan?
Do you put meatloaf?
You can.
No, you don't.
You
actually,
can.
You do it actually no, more like in a regular
can.
Baking pan.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah
not so
way.
Much the meatloaf.
Sounds good.
I mean, we could try it.
Because the fat would have nowhere to go, right?
It's just kind of, yeah, it sort of half poaches in there, but
yeah,
which I'm kind
brown.
Of into,
could
though.
Could be all right.
Yeah.
Brown top,
especially if you're
going to
then crisp it after, like in a skillet. Anyway, digress.
That's why I chose to use a loaf cake. I didn't want to cripple my reader by saying that it had to be made in a 9-inch or a 10-inch cake pan that they'd have to go out and get it. So this is your easy entry carrot cake.
And then also doing the layer thing where you have two cakes and you put the frost in it and all that and cut it, slicing off the top.
It's a big lift.
Yeah. So... Wait, Claire is
signaled.
Raising her
We're
hand
being signaled.
Yeah.
I just have to add an addendum to my description of the cake because there's one
is
important.
Is that redundant, adding an addendum?
Yeah, I guess so. No, I have an addendum to my earlier discussion of the BA's Best carrot cake. Just about one thing that makes it different than your classic carrot cake. And there is one anecdote, which is I based this recipe on my mom's carrot cake recipe, which I believe she got from the Bach for More cookbook, which was the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra's like community
Bach,
cookbook.
Oh,
yes. Which is an excellent carrot cake. But I added buttermilk. So that's something you don't typically see in a carrot cake. But I added it, one, because it just tenderizes the cake overall. But also because in this recipe, one issue that I have with carrot cake often is that, so an average cake, like in a layer, bakes for like a half an hour or so. And in that time, I often find that the carrot like doesn't soften fully. And I really don't love the texture of like al dente carrots in the carrot cake. So in my recipe, you start by grating the carrots and soaking them in the buttermilk mixture. Mm. And then you add that in later when you're alternating with the dry ingredients.
So that tenderizes the carrots?
Right. So it kind of starts to soften them before they get added to the batter.
Okay. So carrots, like A, does it matter what kind you use? B, does it matter? Is it a box grater? Is it a Cuisinart? Like how fine or not fine should the shredded carrots be?
I feel like it doesn't matter that much. I mean, you can go coarse, you can go medium grate, you can do it in the food processor with the discs to grate them quickly, which is always really easy. Or because box graters don't have standard sizes for the holes of the grates. I don't think it matters that much, but certainly if you're going for a much coarser texture, then they might not soften and bake all the way through the way a finer grate might.
Finer grate, I mean, at least for my purposes, like felt like it was just going to release so much water that I was going to end up with like carrot mush.
Okay, so there's a video of Chris Morocco making his
that's
gluten-free
why I
carrot
myself.
Cake. And that is an interesting moment in the video, which reminded me of when I make potato latkes, is when you're taking these handfuls of grated carrots and squeezing out all the excess water that's naturally within carrots. Talk about that.
Yeah, I just felt like it was essential for controlling the moisture in the cake. You know, to Claire's point about, you know, an oil-based cake, you know, it lends itself towards being this like kind of more moist cake just because oil, you know, stays fluid at room temperature. So you really get that sensation of richness when you eat it. But in terms of controlling the moisture in the cake, you know, I don't know. Did you squeeze your carrots out?
No, and they soak in the buttermilk,
Wild.
So they do start to release some liquid.
Interesting.
But I'm not opposed
to the
idea.
You might
want to
try it, Claire.
I would. And then you can, so you're releasing basically water, and then you can replace that liquid back in with a more flavorful liquid,
you know what?
Like a
you
yogurt.
Know what? I think BA's Best carrot cake might need an addendum.
Well, I had 5 eggs in my cake because I needed to build like a huge amount of volume, you know, ribboning
right.
my
That's
eggs
your structure.
With my sugar. That's the structure of my cake because it's gluten-free. You know, so I had a lot of moisture being introduced in the form of those eggs. And then I also needed to get my fat in there, you know, my coconut oil in my case. Already I had a plenty moist enough batter So then it becomes a question of, okay, well, how do you control the other, you know, sort of wet variables? And that meant I had to squeeze those carrots out.
You also don't use flour in yours, so that's not hydrating all of that liquid that you're,
no,
that the carrots are releasing.
Right. I'm using almond meal, which, I mean,
doesn't really hydrate
maybe
at all.
It hydrates like 5%
so
or something.
So the one major difference in your recipe, Chris, is that you're substituting almond meal for regular white flour.
Yeah.
Any other major differences in terms of the gluten-freeness, or are you just adding some things like coconut and coconut oil for flavoring and quote-unquote healthy-ish vibes?
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, and it's hard. I mean, it's a very standard cake. And I think part of showing it, you know, in that two layers, you know, very classic kind of cake format was just kind of convincing people, at least, you know, by eye, that like, this is just as delicious as Claire's cake, you know?
Ooh.
and you know, is leaving nothing behind.
One thing that surprised me, because I remember tasting versions of your cake when you were making it, and what surprises me is that for a gluten-free cake, it has like a very distinct crumb, this sort of way that the cake kind of comes apart and crumbles into these pieces that really mimic, is very, very similar to like a classic carrot cake. So I was super impressed.
Interesting that you mentioned the word crumb, because that was going to be my next question. Mm-hmm. Your cake, Claire, the BA's best, seems to have a, you know, it's, I don't want to say it's crummy, but you just look at the photo and it looks, has some nice crumminess, and it's, I don't want to say it's loose, but kind of a little bit loose. Molly's, yours has a very dense, moist texture, and I'm curious what you did with your loaf cake to get it that more sort of dense moistness compared to Claire's, which has a, just visually you can see the crumb, how different it is.
Yeah, well, so back to the constraints on basically, I didn't want to use a hand mixer or a stand mixer in the recipe. So unlike in Claire's, I'm not beating eggs and sugar together to create volume and space. So naturally, the crumb of the cake is a little bit denser because I haven't created that space in the cake. But also, Claire's has buttermilk as an additional liquid, and mine has cream cheese in the actual batter as well, as a way, because I use cream cheese in the frosting later on, so as a way of using that ingredient twice.
So it counts as one of the 10 ingredients that you can double up on.
You can use the same ingredient twice. Yes. So the cream cheese gets split in half, and then half of it is there, which brings a lot of richness and moisture to the cake, but it also makes it denser. If you think about cream cheese at room temperature, it's thick and dense.
Yeah. Claire, while I loved your BA's best carrot cake, I really enjoy cake that does have that dense moistness like Molly's, that when you slice it, it just feels solid to it.
You get like a clean, smooth slice.
Yeah, a clean slice. It doesn't crumb off, doesn't leave crumbs on the plate typically.
Right. Well, I have two things about that.
Okay.
One is, I think one of the reasons why visually the BA's best carrot cake does it is because there's these inclusions like the walnuts, and they drag.
They tear.
Like they tend to produce visually a slice with more texture.
More going on.
And then also with a loaf cake, even, you know, as Molly pointed out, like the way that the batter was mixed, there's not as much air worked into it. But also just the height of a loaf cake, and because of gravity, like you have a heavier amount of batter over a smaller surface area. So it tends to not bake as light because
it's like a brick just sitting there, whereas on a round pan it kind of spreads out more surface area and air.
Right, exactly. Which is often why you see sometimes with like quick breads at the very, very bottom, there's sort of a denser little layer. Yeah. And that's because it's just a lot of batter like weighing down on itself.
But yeah, because now I think about it, we've done a lot of, you did the pumpkin bread last year, which was one of my favorite recipes. We also had that recipe for chocolate coconut pound cake, which I want to say, no, it wasn't gluten-free. It had all-purpose flour in it. But that was also really dense. And I don't know, I kind of like that for what it is as a departure from some sort of more cakes with the typical crumb. Oh, wait, you have something else to say.
Well, I don't know if you're going to change, like, moving on to the next topic. But I think, like, a requisite part of the conversation has to be cream cheese frosting, which we all opted for, but maybe slightly different variations. I just get very upset when I see a carrot cake that doesn't have cream cheese frosting.
Non-negotiable.
I didn't even try to change that.
No.
I threw in the, you know, the Greek yogurt just as a nod to healthy-ishness, but I mean,
mine doesn't have butter.
Who's I kidding?
Oh, yours is all cream cheese.
Because it's an oil-based cake and I can't just call for butter. Mm-hmm. So my cream cheese frosting is comprised of just sugar, vanilla extract, and cream cheese, which is softened and just paddled a bit until the sugar dissolves and it's spreadable. So it's kind of like a cheater's cream cheese frosting. But I think that at the end of the day, the point is people want sweetened cream cheese with their carrot cake. And that's kind of...
I would go so far as to say every cake should have cream cheese frosting.
I don't necessarily disagree.
Yeah,
so what's in... So yours... What is your cream cheese frosting?
Mine's it's a very classic cream cheese frosting. So it's butter and cream cheese. Although if I remember correctly, the ratio is 1-2, butter to cream cheese.
I'm going to tell you right now because I'm looking at the website. Yeah. It says 12 ounces cream cheese at room temp and then 3/4 of a cup unsalted butter room temp. So
that's like 6 ounces. Yeah, that's right. So 1-2.
2-1. Okay.
And then just powdered sugar. So this is like this style of frosting is like an American buttercream, which is just typically like butter, powdered sugar, maybe a little bit of liquid in the form of milk typically. But for cream cheese frosting, you're just subbing in cream cheese where there would be only butter. So it's really easy. You whip it together. It smooths out so beautiful. This is like a great frosting for adding a lot of texture to a cake because it's so kind of light and fluffy and you really want to like swirl it. But it's super easy. You know, it doesn't require a lot of technique the way that like a buttercream does. And it's so good and it works so well.
There's no egg yolks or whites in there.
No meringue, nothing like that.
And Chris, you're the same ratio. You're doing 8 ounces cream cheese to half a cup, which is 4 ounces of butter.
Exactly.
And then some gluten-free powdered sugar and the Greek yogurt. What does the Greek yogurt do to the texture and the flavor?
It's just adding a little bit of extra tang. It's also, you know, cream cheese, to your point, I mean, it is like kind of miraculous in frostings of all kinds, you know, because it has this stiffness and this body and this tang. So it really plays off of sweetness so like wonderfully. But the Greek yogurt was really just a way to kind of like build in a little bit of additional lightness and a little bit of additional tanginess into that frosting. And we felt like we couldn't do just 100% straight classic, you know, cream cheese frosting for Healthy-ish. We needed to just do something. So we just lightened it up, you know, honestly, by degrees.
Cool. So, guys, you can find all three of these recipes on bonappetit.com for BA's best carrot cake. That's Claire's. Chris's gluten-free carrot cake, which lives over on the Healthy-ish website. And the newest addition to the family, Molly's. What are we calling this one, Molly?
I don't know. I have a working title here, Easy as Peasy's Carrot Loaf Cake, but.
Wow.
I think we're going to go with that.
I don't think you get that many words on, basically.
Yeah, I don't know how we landed on that. It remains to be named.
Well, you'll know it when it comes out. And listeners, if you let us know, raisins or no raisins, you can email us bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Clean the kitchen.
Do you really, though, Emil? Because we're rolling right now, and you have cooked meals with me or by yourself at my house. You leave kind of a...
I don't love to clean.
No.
You know, I will say, though, I feel like as, you know, I'm an older man now. I'm 30. Mm. I feel like my enthusiasm for cleaning has increased over the years. Like wanting to have everything cleaned up. Like, what, you know, cleaning as I go, making sure that things are clean before guests show up. Those are things that I feel like I'm slowly growing to, like, really feel a lot more excited about.
Well, first question, I feel like, and I don't know if this is a statement or a question, but I feel like there's a difference between cleaning and organizing.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And I feel like that's, you know, that's kind of what this whole... basically back of book package is all about, is more organizing than cleaning necessarily.
We're not telling you how to wash dishes.
No, and you know, we're not telling you how to, like, you know, take all of your dishes off of the shelves and like how to clean all, you know, and all the corners and that kind of thing. Yeah. I mean, you know, you should be doing that anyway, I guess. But really, it's like organizing your kitchen, doing a kind of like whole 360, take everything out, look at it, organize it, actually makes you a better cook.
Because you know what you have.
You know what you have. It's more accessible. You know where it is.
I can't tell you how many like jars of Dijon mustard or bags of lentils I have because I'm like, oh, do I need to buy lentils? I think I need to buy some lentils. I'm at the store. I'm going to grab some lentils. You get home and there's like four bags of lentils. You're like, I did not need to buy lentils. You know how many bottles of rice wine vinegar I have in my cupboard? God. Too many.
Well, it's also, it's interesting because you end up with a lot of the things that you, like a lot of iterations of the things that you're afraid to cook without. You know, it's like we have a lot of jars of mayonnaise. Just because, you know, it's like you're at the store, you're like, oh, do we have mayo?
Because you don't want to get home and not have it.
Exactly. Yeah. The stakes feel too high. Same thing with something like rice wine vinegar. You're
steaks?
Like,
steaks? Wait, we're talking steaks? I literally have three, not exaggerating, three jars of half finished mayonnaise in my fridge right now.
Yeah, because you were, sometime last summer, you were like,
gotta have
I'm making BLTs. Do we have mayo?
And you got all right, so let's talk in this package, as we say in the magazine biz.
Is that inside baseball? People don't say, yeah.
Yeah, you also said back of book, which no one who's not in publishing knows. Ugh. So that's the back of the magazine. Clean Up Your Act is what it's called. Wow, you're a mess. The good news, winter's over, so it's high time you put on your hazmat suit and organize that kitchen. Starting with the fridge/freezer, I like to be organized. I always think I keep a pretty organized office here at Bon Appetit.
That's true.
And my wife's fridge/freezer is borderline disaster area.
Yeah.
Like, we need to call in FEMA. It's like, it's I open the freezer. Again, I have no idea what's in there.
Right.
I have no idea how long it's been in there. And also, just the way it's structured, I can't see anything.
Yeah. Well, you have an unfortunate case where you have the under fridge freezer that you pull out, which I feel like the top down, everything is piled necessarily.
It's a lot of piling. And there's always a bottle of like Kettle One vodka on a weird angle and like a Roberta's pizza, and then I can't see anything else.
Well, I mean, I think that the freezer is tough, right? Because the fridge, you know, you look in your fridge every day and, you know, if something smells bad or like whatever, you know that you gotta like get in there and clean it out. The freezer is a little bit trickier because I think people sometimes treat it as if you put something in the freezer and it's in suspended animation.
Like a body or something?
And just never, nothing.
You don't have to deal with it. I was thinking about the Sopranos. There's been a lot of Sopranos talk lately. But no, it's like, yeah, you stick it in there, I'll deal with it later. Whereas the fridge, you open the fridge, it's right there, eye level in front of you. So with the freezer, one thing I've definitely learned since being at BA is that when you put something in the freezer, grab your Sharpie, grab your blue or whatever color masking tape, and label it.
Right.
And say what it is, because like, bolognese also kind of looks like lentil soup, which also kind of looks like gravy or whatever.
Yeah.
Say what it is and say what the date is. Like March 3, 1919.
Absolutely. And the reality is, just because you're putting something in the freezer doesn't mean it lasts forever.
Yeah.
So, you know, ideally, really, you want to get rid of things after, you know, 6 months or so, a year max. It really depends on what the thing is. And I'm not going to say that I've never pulled out, like, a three-year-old pack of lamb chops or something that I found in my friend's freezer and cooked them.
Please,
you know,
please do say that.
I have. It's true. I have done that before. It's just, you know, the things will suffer after a certain amount of time. You know, like the freezers go through certain cycles. Sometimes they thaw a little bit. They freeze a little bit more. You're gonna get freezer burn.
Freezer burn. Do you do, like, I think a lot of us closet-wise will certainly do like a spring, fall, or whatever, winter, summer sort of clean out where we sort of rotate our, I'm not going to be wearing these heavy jackets or suits or whatever in the summer, so I kind of move them someplace else. Do you do that? Do you do a twice a year thing with your freezer?
Yeah. So I like to, at least twice a year, normally sometime in the spring, sometime in the fall, open the freezer, take everything out, put it on a table. You've got a little, you know, if you're a real freak about it, you can put it in a cooler while you're working, but that gives you a chance to actually clean the freezer, and then you look at all the things that you've had there, things that you bought with like the best intentions in mind, like those chicken thighs that were on sale, or right, the chicken stock that you made that you knew you were going to thaw for a
rainy day. I've got like lots of stock that then gets kind of bulbous as it freezes and then gets a little salt crystals on top of the stock but beneath the top. And
Well, and so you take a look at all of that. If you pick something up and you're like, you know, I literally don't know what this is.
And there's not a date on it because you forgot.
Yeah, you're either going to thaw that and use that tonight. Once you figure out what it is, or you should just throw it out, you know?
Yeah.
And then once you're done, you are staring at like limitless possibilities. Now you know that you have, you know, those chicken thighs, you know, you've got some stock, you know, you've got, you know, a package of dumplings that you haven't eaten yet and that you totally forgot about because it was in the back of the freezer. And then make yourself a little list. Just like literally take, you know, half a sheet of paper.
So then where does that list live? So you have like a, not an itinerary, but a, what's it called when a list of stuff in a thing?
An index.
An index of sorts. So you know exactly what's in there. Will you like tape that somewhere on your fridge, or what
would
you do with
that? I'd normally just tape it right to the outside of my freezer, and that way when I'm, you know, and my freezer is kind of at, you know, eye level, so you know, I get up and, you know, I'm walking to the fridge and the first thing I'm going to see is that list, and if I'm like, oh, I need to buy chicken thighs, I'm cooking tomorrow, I'm like, oh no, actually I have chicken thighs here. Take that out to thaw it and then cross it off.
Do you
can also and this is a good trick, also take a picture of that list. So you have it on your phone.
So when you're at the store.
Exactly.
That's so smart. I love that idea. All right. Name three things you always have in your freezer besides ice.
Three things I always have in the freezer besides ice. I almost always have frozen pelmeni, which are little Russian veal dumplings that I get in Brighton Beach. They're like just the perfect, you know, I mean, it's kind of like the Russian answer to the, you know, gyoza or...
More like dumpling style as opposed to like angelotti. They're not like
You know, they're somewhere in between. Yeah. They're kind of in between an angelotti or and like a tortellini and like a gyoza. It's almost kind of like shumai sized.
Yeah.
But those are great. They're actually like best when they're kept frozen. So that's like a really good, easy dinner sort of situation.
You boil them, then you toss them in butter or something or what?
Yeah. Boil them and then either put them into something brothy or get them in a pan full of hot butter.
Because maybe you have some chicken stock in your freezer?
Maybe you have some chicken stock. I wish I could say that I was a person who always has homemade stock in the freezer. I don't always. I almost always have meat in the freezer. You know, like I've got steaks or chops or like, you know, pork shoulder
so
or something
old
like
school.
That. Well, I buy a lot of my meat frozen.
Yeah,
you know,
really?
if you're buying from kind of smaller farms and things like that,
oh, okay. So
a lot of times you're not buying.
You're buying from Flying Pig's farm or something at the green market. You're buying like the grass fed this or that sort of.
Totally, yeah. And so those are the things you buy because they look good, and you're like, I'm not necessarily going to cook these tonight, but those end up in the freezer.
Gotcha. Okay, that's a good point.
I'm trying to think of it. You said three things.
You know, I never did the thing where like you would read about like in Martha Stewart. Love Martha, but like, oh, use your. Ice cube containers and fill them with chicken stock so then you can have little portioned out things of chicken. I never did that. Do you ever do that?
No, I've never done that before.
If you're like a real chefy chef, I like that notion. Like, oh, I'm going to drop a couple of cubes of chicken stock into this pasta sauce. But no.
Yeah, no. I don't really do that. I mean, I will say that if I do get around to making homemade chicken or beef stock, I like to freeze it in multiple sizes of containers. So maybe you have a quart container, a pint container, maybe you have some half pints.
That sounds like a good piece of advice, if I may interject. We've been doing spaghetti and meatball night a lot recently on Sunday nights and stuff. And we typically will make far more than you need. Why not? You know, make 24 meatballs, eat six or eight together as a family, and you got the sauce. I always like to take the leftovers and put those in not the quart containers, but like in three pint takeout things, because each one essentially constitutes a meal for two. So
totally.
I don't want to have to defrost a big one, only eat half of it, then put it in the fridge. So always think about what size are you cooking typically for two people? And if so, that should inform the size of the container in which you are storing things.
Totally. And likewise, if you grab the family pack of, you know, chicken drumsticks because they're on sale, but you're never going to cook 16 chicken drumsticks, put them in a plastic bag, seal them, and freeze them in whatever portion you think you're going to use.
Yeah.
So like, you know, maybe four at a time or whatever. I also really love freezing things like stock in plastic bags, in Ziploc bags.
Yeah, so they can lay flat.
lay again, flat.
Say what it is, date it. We also do. So we have like two nights at the Rapid Buckhouse.
Only two nights. My God, everybody else has seven and you got two?
Yeah, I got two. Got spaghetti meatball night. And then we have chicken katsu schnitzel cutlet night, whatever you want to call it.
That's a great night.
And if you go to the butcher, and you know who does a really good job, and I shout them out a lot, but Dixon's Farm Stand at Chelsea Market, they will pound them thin, each one sort of layered in between the wax paper, you know, mm-hmm. so you have like a nice stack of them. And if I'm going to go get the cutlets and I'm going to do the little breading station with the flour and egg and katsu, and panko, I'm not going to just do four. Right. I'll do 8 or 12, fry up 6 for me, Marlon and Simone, and then take the other ones and always freeze them. But when you freeze fresh things, put them on a sheet tray first, put those in the freezer, let them freeze. And then put them in a bag because you don't want them to stack up and get stuck together.
Right.
Same way if you ever buy fresh pasta or fresh, you know, little dumplings or whatever, freeze them on a tray. And then once they're frozen, you can then throw them in a Ziploc bag like a bag of ice cubes.
Totally. And that's the same goes for freezing any kind of fruit or berries or yes. things like that. Just so that they're not like they're frozen in their individual state.
Exactly.
And then when you
not
get them
clump.
In there, they're not going to be a clump.
All right, I'm getting psyched about the freezer. Organize your fridge like a pro. That was your second point. My refrigerator, typically a mess of too many condiments I don't use, some aging dairy products, leftovers from several nights ago that are now like way in the back. And you're like, oh, that was from like 9 days ago. I probably don't want to eat that. What am I doing wrong in terms of my fridge organization?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously it's like everybody's got their system and whatever works for you works for you. But the thing I think that's most important to think about is what the temperature zones are. So the top of your
Never thought about that.
Top shelf of your fridge is going to be the warmest place. The bottom shelf of your fridge is going to be the coolest place.
Like literally?
So, yeah. And then the crispers are a little bit of a different story. And the door realistically is the warmest because that's the thing. It's like you're opening it up. It's like the closest to the outside. So top shelf is where you're going to want to put your prepared foods, your most of your leftovers, the condiments, things like that. Like the things that are already like, you know, if you got a jar of anchovies, I know you don't, but like if you...
Simone does. Yeah.
Anchovies, capers, things like that, top shelf. Those condiments that are kind of like already maybe a little bit preserved, pickles, jam, all of those things that kind of on their own are kind of, you know, refrigerating them is a bonus, but they'd probably be fine for a certain amount of time outside of the fridge.
Okay.
Then you got your middle, and the middle is where you want your leftovers, and you want to put the oldest in the front, the newest in the back, so that you know, you rotate through. You want your eggs, you want your baking soda, which you should be replacing every month.
What?
Yeah, I know. That's aspirational. I do not replace my baking soda every month.
Emma over here, she just shook her head like, yeah, no.
Oh my God, I'll tell you, we were in San Diego visiting
Lawrence.
Does it
even work or is it all just a ruse?
It works all right. We were in San Diego visiting Lauren's parents and we were baking something and we needed baking soda or maybe we were making a batter or something like that. There was no baking soda in the pantry, and her mom was like, "Oh, there's baking soda in the fridge in the garage." Mm. And we're like, "Oh, okay," and we like grabbed it, and like literally, we picked it up, we opened it, and I was like, "Oh, it'll be fine." And I smelled it, and I was like, "This smells like old fridge.
That's
like
not good.
it is indeed sucking up the bad smells in your fridge. It costs like $2, so it's like it's worth it to just." You know,
that could be a new cologne. There's like Old Spice and there's Old Fridge.
Old Fridge. So you got your baking soda in there. And then the bottom shelf, which is the coldest part of the fridge, is where you want to put your meats, you know, and you want to have those on a plate or a platter or like a rimmed baking sheet because, you know, sometimes they're going to leak and the worst. But like, you've lived in a place at some point in your probably like much younger life where there was like some meat on the top shelf and it was dripping down through like all of the other shelves and like everything is like, you know, that's what you want to try to avoid. And this is also these are some of the rules that apply to like, you know, professional kitchens too. It's like you want you want the drippy meat to be on the bottom
yeah.
and in something so it's not going to contaminate everything else. That's where you want your milk.
Yep, dairy.
And then, you know, and then you've got your drawers. You want your, you know, you want to have your vegetable crisper and your fruit crisper. And those actually, you do want them separate because the fruits do actually, like, kind of give off some gases and enzymes that ripen other things. So you kind of want to keep those things separate.
Oh, so like cats and dogs and stuff, we want to separate so the fruit literally stays separate than the veg.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And
okay.
then, you know, and then you've got your cheese drawer.
Ideally,
if you have a fridge that has a cheese yeah. drawer, like that's, you want to keep cheese in there. And it's not just because it's called the cheese drawer, but because if you've got some gorgonzola in there, you don't really want your, you know, you want to have as much of a barrier between your, you know, yeah. gorgonzola and your eggs as possible. So keeping them in your its own thing is nice.
I think in general, the one thing you had mentioned also with like taking, knowing what's in your freezer, knowing what's in your cupboards, I think that's such an important part of it also. I always forget what is in my quote-unquote crisper, like my mm-hmm. veg drawer. And I can't tell you how many times I bought a head of parsley where I have parsley at home, or I forgot, like, do I have romaine at home? And I just feel like maybe I just need to be spending more time in my fridge looking and paying attention.
Yeah.
You have a nice little list here. Three things you should/shouldn't be refrigerating. You have take out of the fridge, onions, potatoes, tomatoes, of course, never in the fridge, avocados, unless, however, once avocados are ripe, I then put them in the fridge to suspend their ripeness.
Sure.
Okay. Hot sauce. I always keep hot sauce in the fridge. I don't have to.
Look, here's what I'll say on hot sauce. I wish we could have dedicated an entire column to the hot sauce thing. It's like, hot sauces are, most hot sauces, because of their composition, which is to say, like, you know, very spicy and yep. very acidic, they do not necessarily need to be refrigerated. They can sit out on the counter. The other reality is you have too many hot sauces in your fridge.
Yeah, I do.
Pick the two that yeah. you actually like and use all the time. Keep them on your counter. When you run out, go buy more. But like having eight different hot sauces, including like four that have like a skull and crossbones
no,
on
you
them.
Don't need
you
those.
You don't need them. So it's like stop waste. You know, it's a precious resource. Your fridge space.
You say put in the fridge vermouth because vermouth is
wine.
A wine, not a liquor. Mm-hmm. Vinegars.
Yep.
Why?
Well, I mean, vinegars also
they're
alive. I mean, if you're buying good vinegar, it's alive and it is going to kind of change.
Yeah.
The longer it sits out.
Okay.
So if you want to
preserve it.
Again, you know, maybe have three vinegars
yeah.
that you use all the time and keep those in there.
I have ones fancy nuts you don't use often. Okay, that preserves them as well.
Yeah, if you're going to buy pine nuts or something like that.
Oh, pine nuts. You know, I leave them out. Yeah, and they get all kind of rancidy. Nuts.
Yeah, they get... they. Yeah.
All right, thank you for that. And finally, eye drops, parentheses, they just feel good.
You know, that was Alex Beggs, the writer for this story, who, I mean, I don't do that, but I'm gonna take her word for it.
A couple more points before we roll. We've all got one, the junk drawer.
Declare war on the junk drawer.
Yeah, because the fascinating thing about the junk drawer is how similar they are, even though they just have a random assortment of crap in them, and yet we all have oftentimes the same random assortment of crap. Like there's that like meat thermometer that you bought 8 years ago and you just bought a new one because you forgot that the 8 year ago one was like way in the back of the junk drawer.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think the
skewers, lots of skewers.
The reality is so just like take a second and acknowledge that you have a drawer called a junk drawer.
Yes.
So you don't need junk in your life.
No.
That is not a thing you need. So everything in your junk drawer breaks down into three categories. You have the actual junk. You know, you have like receipts, manuals for appliances you don't own anymore, like those kind of keys that you can't remember what
exactly.
door they went
yeah.
to. Throw it out.
Yeah.
That it does not spark joy. Throw it out. Two, you have things that are in there that belong somewhere else. You know what I mean?
Mm.
There is like the, you know, the extra floss belongs in the bathroom. The like, you know, your Advil belongs in the medicine cabinet. Like things that just like you didn't put in the right place
yeah,
and you
just
threw
it
in the junk drawer.
Up there.
And then you have the things in life that actually have no place, you know, like toothpicks, like different like electronic charging cords,
yeah.
like a few votive candles, You know, the emergency flashlight and things like that. You can just organize.
Yeah, so I'm a big fan of any of those sort of like Bed Bath Beyond organizing stores where you get the little dividers.
Yeah,
stick them in there just so each place has at least a little.
Totally.
Home.
Or you know, you can DIY it a little bit if you have like old cell phone boxes. You know, the iPhone boxes that are nice and sturdy and low profile.
I like that. Yeah.
Use those, or like even a takeout container or something, just to create kind of compartments, and then put you know the like things. If you got the wires and cords, you know, bind them up with rubber bands. That they don't take up too much space. You know, just like acknowledge that you need a place for
junk.
Yeah,
give it a little miscellaneous things.
Yeah.
Do you, let me ask you a little something. Do you save takeout menus or are you fully digital on the takeout delivery?
We don't really do that.
Oh my God.
No, I just.
I like to have, like, so there's a couple places I order from. Like, if I'm going to order from Shorty Tang's, getting some noodles and stuff, like, I'd like to look at the old fashioned takeout menu. And go, oh, let's get the stir-fry string beans with ground pork. Yeah.
Call in your order?
I do.
That's cool. No, I fully support that. I'm not trying to be like annoying. I probably get delivery like twice a year. And we live in New York. It's so close.
You should come to the Raffle Buck House. All right, finally, number five. These tools make cleaning easier. Again, now we're getting to cleaning, organizing, but it's nice to have cleaning tools. Cleaning your kitchen does indeed suck. Nothing will make it fun, but it can be less agonizing, and the four tools below make a difference. Number one, toothbrush. See, it's weird because I used to keep the toothbrush in my bathroom.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, once you I'm not going to say you should use your worn out toothbrush for this, but you know, get a firm bristled toothbrush.
Yes, firm.
And for all of those kind of nooks and crannies in your sheet pans.
Yeah, the sides and the corners.
You know, yeah, when you like open up your Dutch oven and the lid has that little lip. Like,
it's horrifying because you go months without noticing that and then you look and you're like, oh my God.
Well, it's just nice to have something like a toothbrush there to get it, especially also for like appliances like your food processor.
Yeah.
They're like, it's nothing but nooks and crannies.
Yeah. Is this, and do I keep that toothbrush in my junk drawer?
I would keep it, you know, in whatever you keep your sponge
in, my junk drawer
or whatever.
Ooh, I like this one. Number two, hand vacuum. Suck up onion skins and spilled sesame seeds.
Yeah, you know that time where you kind of like...
It's like a dustbuster sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Like you dump, you know, yes, you spill something, a little bit of sugar, and it's like behind the thing.
I
and
have
the
other an 11-year-old boy.
Yeah.
There's crap everywhere all the time.
Exactly.
Ooh, this is a nice one I don't have. Putty knife.
I love my putty knife. It just lives like right by the sponge.
Yeah.
And whenever you've got a sheet pan and you roasted something really hard and you got some like stuck on sugar.
Or maybe you left it in there longer than you thought you were supposed to. And all of a sudden you smell something burning and you're like, oh shit.
Yeah, totally. That. Just to really get those things up.
Yeah. Or cast iron skillet, getting the little crispy bits. I love that. Finally, this is so like old school British. Bottle brush.
I know. I mean, it looks like a toilet brush.
Yes.
Let's just be real about that. But, you know, now you can buy a purpose-built bottle brush. OXO makes them. They're great. And it just like, you know, you and I cannot get our hands into even a wide mouth mason jar. You know, it's just a little bit too much. Or like a water bottle or something like that. Like, that's the thing you need to get into your decanter or your whatever. It just makes life easier.
Emil Stonik, thank you for joining us today. You can check out Emil and Alex Begg's story in the April issue of Bon Appetit, Clean Up Your Act.
It's in the back of the book.
Back of the book. Thanks, Emil.
Thank you.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
you know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.